All right, where do we leave off at?
30.
We're at on 30.
I think we're at the top.
Itticisms. All right, definition for itticism. Reduplication or mixing of vowels and diphthongs. Reduplication of or mixing vowels and diphthongs. What is a diphthong? Nobody knows. Yeah, there's that. And then the trick in Greek is there's no letter for H in Greek. So, for instance, if you have it this way or you have it this way, that's the difference between oi and hoi. So that right there is considered a diphthong. Puts the H on the front of the word because there's no H in Greek. Example, look over in John chapter number 12. Somebody read John 12:41. All right, so in the Greek, what they ended up doing, the word for when is OT. So they ended up putting AT, which changes it from when to because. So a lot of them, if you were to translate, would say, these things said Isaiah because he saw his glory and spake of him. So, slight difference. Next one's called eye wandering. Eye wandering is the eye picks up at the wrong spot, usually omitting words or phrases. The eye picks up at the wrong spot, usually omitting words or phrases. Example of that is over in John 6:55. Somebody read John 6:55.
For my flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed.
All right, so the problem is that in the Greek you have the word althes show up twice. That's the translated word is indeed. So because you have indeed twice, what happens a lot of times is your eye wanders. So a lot of times they'll skip over that middle part. So for my flesh is meat indeed, and they'll just skip over it, the rest of the verse because of the indeed there, the althes. Spelling errors, of course. This is simple. Go to Romans 12. Romans 12, 11. So you have an error in spelling. Even in the Greek, they had spelling errors. And if you spell the wrong word in the Greek, when you go to translate that word, it comes out different. Somebody read Romans 12:11.
Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord.
So what happens is they will spell curio to Cairo. And the difference is, this means Lord, this means season. So again, if you were to reread it, not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving in season is what some have because of a spelling error. Next one is similarity of letters. That's basically that, like, the end of two words are similar. They have an O-I or something along those lines. So because of that, it just, you have issues there. There's one case, I forget where it's at. I think it's in Matthew, but it talks about how they mess up. O-I is dropped because it's the same. So basically an article is dropped, O-I. Omicron iota is dropped, because it's the same ending for the word Sadducees that's right next to it. So it just gets dropped because of the similarity of letters, basically. Next one is insertions. Adds something in to make sense to the scribe or writer. Adds something in to make sense to the scribe or writer. Now the difference is there is insertions all throughout your King James Bible, but what are they? They're in italics, and how do they let you know that they inserted it? They italicize words that are not in the Greek. And the problem is, of course, Greek is not a what you would call a complete language. I've brought it up before with the missionaries over in Papua New Guinea. When they have to speak pidgin, there's no word for crying. So when they want to say that I was crying, you have to say I had water running down my face, coming down my cheek, is basically what they have to say, because they don't have a word for crying. Well, in the Greek, there are some things that are implied or inferred. So for instance, if I want to say I know so in English, okay, I'm speaking about me, so I say I know so, but in the Greek it's like gnosko. So they don't like tell you ahead of time. There's no article. They don't tell you who's speaking. It's implied and inferred in the conjugation of the verb. So there's a lot of things even in Hebrew and Greek that are kind of like you have to read between the lines. So when we translate from Hebrew or Greek into English, the King James translators had to add things in. They had to insert things to make it grammatical sense in English, and they did so by italicizing words. So what people would like to say is, oh, well, the King James added stuff all over the place. Well, yeah, you have to, because if you don't, it doesn't make sense. It's incomplete sentences and phrases in your English Bible if you don't have that. So they added it in, but they let you know by italicizing it that, hey, there's no proof for this, but we put this in so that the verse makes sense. And that doesn't mean that they, like, changed the text. They just said, like, you know, there's incomplete sentences. So they add things in to make it grammatically correct, whether it's an article or a verb or something along those lines. I mean, go ahead and try to open up your Bible sometime and then read it without the italicized words in it. It's impossible, because it would not make any sense. I think there's one place in the Old Testament, talks about a plot of ground that a yoke of oxen might plow. And what, if you look at that verse, I think it's in Kings or something like that, maybe in Judges, it just says, like, a plot of ground, a yoke, if you remove the italicized words. Well, that doesn't make sense. You know, what does a yoke have to do with a plot of ground? So the King James translators, because they don't have that in Hebrew, they added in that a yoke of oxen might plow. Because if you just put in there a plot of ground, a yoke, well, what's that mean? That doesn't make any sense in reference to the size of the property, for instance. So they added that in. But in doing so, they said they italicize that phrase there, that a yoke of oxen might plow. Mistaken abbreviations. We already went over this one. That happens a lot with the nomina sacra. So that we went over 1 Timothy 3:16 is the good example, where you have the theta sigma and then the omicron sigma. And that changes, of course, the word from God was manifest in the flesh to who was manifest in the flesh. It removes God out of 1 Timothy 3:16. Then you have heirs of judgment. Heirs of judgment are basically just, I would say, these are when opinions are being pressed upon the text, if you will. So a great example is, like we've talked about before, Mark chapter 16, verses 9 through 20. A lot of versions or a lot of scholars have removed that, and they say because it's from a different writer. So again, they're just... their judgment is, well, we're going to leave this out. We're going to leave the last chapter in the book of Mark incomplete because we think it was done by a different writer. Another thing they do is you can write down John 19:14. And what happens in some of them is that a scribe switched Gentile time for Jewish time. Now, what's the importance of Gentile versus Jewish time? When does a Jew's day start? 6 p.m. When does your day start? 12 midnight. That's the difference, and it's a big difference. I mean, this is why you'll argue till you're blue in the face with some people about Good Friday and how Jesus Christ was not actually crucified on Good Friday. Because I don't know, it might be... maybe just me because I'm a Polack, but like I don't understand how you get from Friday to Sunday morning. How do you fit in 3 days and three nights right there?
Right.
It's kind of hard. Well, a lot of it's because, well, they didn't realize that there was a special high Sabbath in there, so therefore a lot of people get off on that. But it's literally impossible to fit 3 days and three nights from even Friday morning to Sunday morning. It's impossible. A good example of that is even in the book of Genesis, when God's making things, when he's creating things, what does he say? The evening and the day. Their day starts with the evening and ends with the day, which is very backwards to us if you think about it. Especially for Gentiles, we don't think that way. We don't think that like, oh, it's nighttime, it's the start of a new day. Yeah. It's the opposite for you. It's like when the sun goes down, oh, the day's over, then we go to sleep and wake up and start a new day. It's the opposite for Jews. This is why if you want to get ice cream at Mitchell's in Solon, you want to get it before 6 p.m. on Saturday because then the Jews all come back out because Sabbath is over. So if you get ice cream at Mitchell's, you want to go after 6 p.m. on Friday night because none of the Jews are there. Next one is wrong word divisions. It's not funny. We are not anti-Semites here.
Do they serve kosher ice cream?
They do. It's all kosher. In Greek or English? He's taking notes. Wrong word divisions. Look over in Mark chapter number 8. So I'm going to read Mark 8, 1.
In those days, the multitude being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples unto him and saith unto them.
So wrong word division is basically what happens is dividing. Let's see, what does it say? Dividing the prepositional phrases onto the wrong thing, onto the wrong article, I guess you would say. So Some places will have Jesus called his disciples and saith unto them, and the unto him just kind of gets misplaced from here and there, and it gets divided up wrong. The next one after that is intentional errors. Look at Luke chapter 2. So I'm going to read Luke 2, verse number 40.
And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him.
So there'll be intentional errors, like the child grew and waxed strong in spirit and wisdom. And it says... That's not right. I'll have to figure that one out. I don't have something right in my notes. We'll come back to that next week. Last one is anakaluthon. Anakaluthon means not following. Sentences changes abruptly mid-sentence. Anakaluthon. So the phrase or the sentence is not following. It just kind of falls off. Sentences change abruptly mid-sentence. Look over in Mark chapter 11:32. Someone to read Mark 11:32. All right, so what will happen is this, is it'll just drop off in verse number 32. But if we shall say of men, they feared the people, for all men counted John. And then the verse ends. What's the problem with that? Well, what do they do to count John? What does that mean? They counted him as, okay, that's one John. The end. They didn't finish the phrase. Another example is, go to Galatians chapter 6. Somebody read Galatians 6:1. What they have in some of them is, brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself. They live off, they just mid-sentence drop off, lest thou also be tempted. And again, when you do that, considering thyself, well, what does that mean, considering thyself? Unless I also can be tempted. I also can fall. This could happen to me just as easy as it did somebody else. Do I have the rest of this written out for you?
Yes.
Okay. So, quickly, we'll go over this. Variations and additions of the Receptus. This, again, kind of, I guess, proves that you can't just say that my final authority is the Textus Receptus, because the Textus Receptus means receive text. It's plural. And they don't always agree. Look at Luke chapter 17. Somebody read Luke 17:36.
taken and the other left.
All right, so Stephanus's third edition omits the verse altogether. Why do we need verse 36 in the text? What's the importance of it? Is it the rapture? What is it, Cheryl, as you shake your head? It's the second coming. But read the verse in front of it. Somebody read the verse in front of it and the verse after it.
Two women.
Two women.
Shall be grinding together. The one shall be taken and the other left. And 37, and they answered and said unto him, Where, Lord? And he said unto them, Wheresoever the body is, thither will the eagles be gathered together.
All right, that eagles being gathered together, what's that? The great feast at the Valley of Megiddo, if you will, when there's going to be, it's going to take them 7 years to clean up all those bodies. And that's at the end of the tribulation. All right. Elsevier Brothers have that. Beza has it. And so does your King James Bible. So the question is, does this mean that we throw out Stephanus' third edition? No. Why do we not throw it out? Why do you still need it? This is the deer in the headlights look from all of you right now. Why do we not throw out a Greek New Testament text just because it does not line up with the King James in every spot? Well, if that's the case, then you have to throw out all manuscript evidence because there's not one manuscript that lines up with the King James every time. The question is, the sum of most parts of that text, does it line up with the King James? Is it in the majority with the King James? Stephanus is, so you don't throw it out. Look at Luke chapter 2. Somebody read Luke 2:22. All right, so what happens is you have Erasmus and Stephanus translate that to their purification. Well, who had to get purified? Just the mother, right? If Joseph got purified, would that make any difference? Why would Joseph have to get purified? Did he have a baby? No. Was he even the father? No. So Joseph does you no good. What about Jesus Christ? Does he have to be purified? No, because babies don't need to be purified. He's already pure, besides the fact he is God in the flesh, right? But let's resort back to the Old Testament. What does the Old Testament say? Old Testament says that when a woman gives birth, she's got to do what? She has to perform her days of purification. I think it's 7 days at least, and then there has to be... True, depending on if it's a boy or a girl. But then, after all that, what does she have to do? She's got to make an offering for her purification, which generally, if you're a poor person, that's a turtle dove, two turtle doves. The King James has her purification, as does Beza and Elsevier. So again, these guys are, they don't bat 1,000. But again, you can't just say, well, Beza is it, or Stephanus is it, or Elsevier Brothers are it. They are my final authority. Because again, you're going to find as we go through this list, they don't all line up with the King James Bible. And that's okay. Look at Romans 8:11. Somebody read Romans 8:11. Romans 8:11.
But if the spirit of him that raised up Jesus from the
Erasmus and Stephanus again have because of his spirit rather than by his spirit. I mean, the question is, why are you sealed right now until the day of redemption? Is it because of his spirit or by his spirit or through his spirit? It's by his spirit. Next one, look over in, go to Romans 12:11. We just kind of hit this one already. Someone read Romans 12:11 again.
Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord.
All right, Erasmus and Stephanus have serving in season or in time. Why do they have that? Because of a spelling error. So does this mean we throw out the whole thing? No, what they could have done is just fixed the spelling error and they would have fixed everything, but... The King James, the Beza, and Elsevier have serving the Lord. Page 31. Next one, John 16:33. John 16:33. Someone give that a read. Read that one more time.
16:33, right?
Mm-hmm.
These things I have spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world.
All right, so Erasmus and Stephanus omit, in the world you shall have tribulation. Why is that important? What's a guarantee besides death and taxes if you're a Christian? You're going to have tribulation. You're going to have suffering. I mean, the pattern that has been set up is Jesus Christ, then the Apostle Paul, and now you. You get to suffer. Which is not fun, but you know what is the opposite of that? The opposite is your neo-age, your non-denominational of 2026, that God just wants you to prosper. Where's that in the Bible? That's Old Testament. That's not right now. Go back a page real quick. I did find out the, was that intentional errors? I figured it out. Luke 2:40. What other versions will say, the child grew and became strong, filled with the Spirit, and the favor of God was upon him. Your King James says the grace of God was upon him. What's the difference between favor of God and grace of God? Do those words mean the same thing? No, they do not. So what do? They intentionally err by just replacing words. You'll see this time and time again. And again, I think I've brought this up before. What happens now is what publishers have done is if I have, for instance, I have an old lexicon from Dr. Ruckman. And if you look at the definitions in that lexicon, they pretty much, I would say 95%+ line up with the definitions that are in your King James Bible. But that's because that lexicon was published in the early 1900s. Now the ones that have been published in the last 20 years, guess who they line up with? Guess what the definitions line up with? Mainly the ESV and the NIV. Why is that? Well, they've decided that, well, we don't just think that this word means grace. This word now means favor and a few other things. The problem is it's almost justifying the new versions that come out to change the translations or the definitions of words because they're like, oh, we're going off of what scholars say nowadays. So just like, for instance, in your Bible, I think it's in the New Testament, it talks about wearing gay apparel. What does that mean? Bright, colorful, right? Happy. That's what the original intention of the word gay was happy, not homosexual. When did that change? In the last 60 years? that has changed. I mean, another great one is, for instance, if you go over to England and you ask for a cigarette, do you know what they call cigarettes in England? Fags or faggots. And if you look at the original definition of fag or faggot, it means a small piece of kindling. It's a match, basically. Like, it's that's what they call them. But we don't, that you can't use that in America in 2026 because you'll get in trouble. I mean, another great one is, for instance, retard, right? There's another one you're not allowed to use anymore. What do we have to use? Sure, all of them, including Russ's. Now, the thing is, for instance, if we were to talk with Phil this morning about driving a truck, they have a thing in semi-trucks called a Jake brake. What's the original name of that called? Engine retarder. Because you are literally retarding the engine to slow it down. And if you look in manuals, it's still in there and it's still called the same thing, but you can't use that word anymore because it means something different now. Well, we could go on and on about different definitions and how they've changed over, you know, the last 20 years, the last 30 years, 40, 60 years. I mean, if we went back, for instance, and if you tried to like read Shakespeare today and try to understand Shakespeare today, most kids, for instance, can't understand it because it's so vastly different than the English we speak today. Just like you talk with Josh, with his boss there at the city, who's Greek, and you talk to him about speaking Greek now with his mother versus what they were speaking in Jesus' day, it's completely different. And the thing is, what they're doing now with lexicons, they're changing definitions of words to line up with modern versions of the Bible to further justify things. And again, you'll get in arguments with individuals about like, well, it doesn't say that. Well, what does the lexicon say? Well, the lexicon, like, again, is like, it's kind of like this. Who makes the best dictionary today? Everyone will say, well, dictionary.com or Merriam-Webster. Well, technically, Merriam-Webster is trash. What is it, 1828? If you go all the way back to Webster's 1828 dictionary, it's way better than what we have today. And again, if you were to take a version of Merriam-Webster's from 2010 and line it up with Webster's 1828, the definitions are going to be very different. And the problem you run into is, okay, what's the final authority on definitions of words? What did Martin Luther say? Solo scriptura, you let the Bible interpret itself. What does your Bible do a lot of times? If you don't understand something, if you read the context of that verse or you go to a cross-reference somewhere else, the word will define itself. But that's what you have a lot of times in these new versions, is they will just out and out lie and say, well, Jesus Christ was growing up and he had favor with God. Well, I would hope so, considering he is God. And they change the word grace to favor. And some people say, well, that's really not important. I think it's kind of important. And changing a definition, I mean, if you start there, where does it end then?
Right.
I mean, a great example is like in your NIV where we talked about before, where, you know, the list of things over there in Corinthians shall not inherit the kingdom of God. And, you know, the one thing on there is effeminate, and your NIV changes it to homosexual offenders. That's not even close to the same word as effeminate. What is effeminate? Non-masculine, right? More ladylike than male-like, right? Soft, sensitive, right? How is that even remotely close? Any of those synonyms, how are any of those close to homosexual offenders? It's not. So what do they do? Well, we're just going to change the definition of that Greek word to homosexual offenders because we can. And so now what they're doing is they figured, well, we have to cover our backside by not just changing what God said, but now we have to go back and we have to alter lexicons so that the lexicons basically prove what we're doing is correct. So if you take a early 1900s, mid-1900s, early 2000s, and modern lexicon and did side-by-side comparisons, you would have four different definitions. And again, the problem is, well, which one's the authority? Is it the old one? Is it the new one? Is it the middle age? And you could go about this all day long. The real question is this: where's your final authority? Is it a dictionary? Is it modern grammar? Is it the Textus Receptus? Is it the original languages, the original manuscripts? Go to John chapter number 1, verse 28. Somebody read John 1, 28. All right, Stephanus puts Bethany instead of Bethabara. It's a common mistake. And the King James, Beza, Erasmus, and Alzever all have Bethabara. Look at 1 Timothy chapter number 1. 1 Timothy 1 verse 4. All right, so Stephanus has dispensation of God, whereas your King James, Beza, Erasmus, and Elzevir have godly edifying. You got Hebrews 9, 1 there. Somebody read Hebrews 9, 1. All right, so notice, what do you have in your King James Bible? First what? But what do you notice about the word covenant? It's italicized. So they imply it, basically, that it's talking about the first covenant, it's talking about the worldly sanctuary, it's talking about the tabernacle, if you will. Stephanus leaves the word out and implies tabernacle, whereas the King James, the Beza, and Erasmus have first covenant. What's the difference between first covenant and tabernacle?
One's a place.
One's a place. True. The first covenant of the Old Testament is what? I mean, if we're talking about old covenant, new covenant, what do you have? I mean, the whole book of Hebrews is based upon a better covenant, and that better covenant is Jesus Christ, correct? Well, the whole thing about Hebrews 9:1 is talking about, and verily the first covenant had also the ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary. What about your tabernacle now, your covenant now? What is it in? Where does the Holy Spirit of God reside right now? You are the temple. You are the tabernacle. Look at James chapter number 2. Last one, James chapter number 2. Are you guys getting excited that your packet's almost done? Somebody read James 2:18. All right, so you have Erasmus and Stephanus, rather than what the King James says there in the middle of the verse, without thy works, they put by thy works. So they would read it this: yea, a man may say, thou hast faith and I have works, show me thy faith by thy works, and I will show thee my faith by my works. Slightly different, correct? But again, the King James and Beza have without thy works, like you have in front of you. The rest of the page is about the papyrus or the papyri bearing witness to the Receptus. You can read that on your own time. It says all those cross-references there. There are 150 distinctively Byzantine readings in the New Testament that cannot be found in any other family. Only 30% of the New Testament has papyri attestations, and much of that in only one papyrus. If we had three papyri covering all points of the New Testament, there would appear more than 5,000 early Byzantine readings before Sinaiticus or Vaticanus. What they're saying is that the papyrus fragments are older than Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, and like it says here, that there is quite a bit of Byzantine or Antiochian or Syrian readings, basically King James readings, in those papyrus fragments. And then it gives you the three major papyri underneath that, P45, P66, and P75, and that is your packet. Next week, what we'll do is I'm going to start going over the Greek alphabet. So you guys are really going back to school. You get to learn a new alphabet. And then after that, we will get into how to use a lexicon. How are you going to find out? Because the thing is, yes, it's helpful to know Greek and Hebrew, but at the same time, you don't need to know Greek and Hebrew. But if someone were to ask you what this like word means in Greek or Hebrew, I'm going to make it so that you can actually look up the definition of said word. That way, you actually know what the alphabet is in Greek, and you can somewhat figure it out on your own. Once we have that down, then we can move on to doing the slideshow probably the week after. And the slideshow, basically, we're going to go verse by verse, and we're going to compare newer versions to the King James, and we're going to see why the King James has what it has, and we're going to see why the NIV, the ESV, the RSV, ASV all have what they have. So it's a lot more fun after this, and you will probably get a lot more ticked off and not so sleepy in Sunday school. Any questions so far? Is anybody bored yet? Just Don. Okay, good.